we'd never met and who, until they moved in, hadn't met each other either. Two beds in the living room, two in the bedroom, and the smallest kitchen I'd ever seen. The apartment was run by NYU Housing, so hundreds of 19-year-olds had lived there before us. There was no curtains, no air conditioning, and the whole place smelled like fresh piss. It was perfect. That June, the Rangers and Knicks were both in the playoffs. The World Cup was happening, and the gay games were just getting started all at the same time. The city was bonkers. It was 100 degrees every day, and it felt like a fight was about to break out on every street corner. We hadn't even hit July yet, and New Yorkers were already fucking sick of it. They were done. I convinced myself that New York was the answer to everything because I had the freedom to reinvent myself into anything I wanted to be, over and over again. Every morning before work, I'd sit and have a coffee on the same stoop at the same time and watch the same guy run up and down Broadway wearing only a pair of women's pantyhose pulled up past his belly button with no underpants. Everything was all mashed up and deformed under there, and you could see it all. People would say hi, and he'd tell them to fuck off. This was his routine. This was New York. You could be anything you wanted to be. Me, I wanted to be smart. I wanted to have something to offer. I wanted to matter. I didn't want to be a dumb skit anymore. To put this into context for the hardcore Stern fans, I started my internship the same day Gay Rich did. Gay Rich went on to become a legend on that show. Sure, I was Howard's first Canadian intern, but Rich was Howard's first gay intern. There was no way I could compete with that. Not on that show. Howard mentioned me once on air, not by name or anything, but he said he had a Canadian intern now. Of course, Howard used this as an opportunity to show how awesome he was, how international he'd become, though for me, it was still one of the greatest moments of my life. The goal for every single person who ever walked through the doors of that show was to get airtime, to be invited in, to become a character, to shine. About 2 weeks in, Carol handed me a blank sheet of printer paper and a Sharpie and asked me to write Howard's promo for the end of the show. These were all plugs for what was coming up on the show the next day, promoting what the guys were up to that night. One of them, Stuttering John, was doing an appearance at Tower Records that evening. I wrote it all up, handed it to Carol, and she walked it down the hall and handed it to Howard's producer. I sat in the corner of the office with my ear pressed against the speaker of this tiny radio on Carol's desk. And tonight at 9, Stuttering John will be at the Times Square Tower Records singing. John, are you singing tonight? Howard asked. No, John stuttered. It's a signing, an autograph signing. He stuttered harder. Howard read the words I wrote one time and one time only, and it was clear that I didn't know the difference between singing and signing. Now, you could chalk it up to nerves or a simple mistake or whatever, but I didn't. I could have looked at that promo for 100 hours, and I still wouldn't have been able to find my mistake. This killed me. This ruined me. This was the closest I ever got to being on with Howard, and I blew it in front of 15 million people. Who wrote this? Was the last thing I heard Howard say before I shut the radio off. I spent the next couple of months keeping my head down, obsessively and quietly observing. I made notes about everything. I watched how people did things, figured out who did what, and got a handle on how they ran the office, how they produced the show. Sure, the Stern Show was wild, and the office was fun, but it wasn't the frat house environment you might imagine. There were days when the guys in the studio would be painting strippers' boobs because it was someone's birthday or some shit, but the office, just on the other side of those doors, might as well have been a bank or an H&R Block. It was all business, and people took it very seriously. I spent most of my internship working on the paperback version of Private Parts, Howard's first book. Most days, I worked alone. Being broke in New York is different from being broke in other places. If you're broke in LA, you can always go to the beach. But New York has a way of reminding you over and over how broke you are. Everything you can't afford is right in front of your face. All the time. I couldn't afford shit, so I walked. I'd take the subway to Soho and walk up to Central Park, grab a beer, smoke a few cigarettes, then walk back down to Union Square. I'd go for drinks in the East Village at Coney Island High or the Notel Motel, then stumble back up to Times Square to wander around for a bit before hitting up a peep show. Times Square was still sleazy then. It was beautiful. I had long since figured out that if you showed up at a peep show looking like you were going to throw up in the booth, they wouldn't let you in, so you had to always sober up a bit first. One of those nights, while sitting alone on Broadway, hoping I'd be able to walk straight enough to spend my last 10 bucks on peep show tokens, trying to connect with a naked stranger on the other side of a filthy plexiglass wall, I had one of the most devastatingly beautiful moments of my life. It was like someone flipped a switch and shut the city down. I remember looking down at the toes of my shoes as I smashed a cigarette butt underneath my Converse. Then all of a sudden, nothing. Absolute silence. I looked up, and for 30 seconds, I was alone. I caught the perfect New York wave. I don't know if it was the way the streetlight cycled or where all the people went, but for that quick moment, it was empty. It was just me. There wasn't one other person or car in sight, and everything just went quiet. For a half a minute, I was the only human being in one of the busiest places on earth. I'd never felt so small and alone before. Then, in the amount of time it took to light another smoke, everything changed. Everything went back to normal. Except me. I was done. The next morning, I called home to talk to my pops. I didn't really have anything to say, but I needed a laugh and a pep talk. I couldn't tell him I was failing or how sad I was. I just felt so bloody heavy. My heart hurt every day. When I wasn't being the most invisible intern in the history of the Howard Stern Show, or sitting alone in an East Village dive bar, I'd lock myself in our tiny bathroom back at the apartment and hurt myself. I burned myself more in those few months than I had in years. Dad wasn't home when I called, but my brother was. And he had big news. Huge. He told me he'd just got a loft in Toronto with a coworker, a big industrial joint right downtown that had one of those cool elevators that went right up into your place. I asked if there was any space for me. Of course, he said. Always. Cool. I'm coming home. Mickey Rooney was an asshole. Kill at least 10 roaches before bed, and the last one to turn out the lights had to reset the mouse traps. Those were the only rules in the loft. A few weeks before I moved in, while I was still in New York, my dad showed up in Toronto with a truckload of lumber and tools and built out 3 bedrooms for me, Rich, and our roommate Parker. It all looked a bit wonky and homemade, but we all had our own rooms now, with a ladder and a space up top for a couch and a TV. It wasn't perfect. None of my dad's projects ever were, but it worked. We had 1,200 square feet, a bar fridge, a hot plate, and roaches. We had a big cockroach problem. The space sure wasn't pretty or well-maintained at all, and technically, we weren't even allowed to live there. The guy my brother swung the deal with was happy to take our money, but it wasn't legal, so we had nobody we could complain to or ask to fix things when they broke or fell apart. Every pair of socks I owned was soon covered in holes because the floors had nails popping up everywhere, and we were missing so many windows that in the winter, you could stick your arm right out and catch snow if you wanted to. We rented out half the space on Tuesday and Thursday nights to an art school for nude life drawing classes. And shortly after I moved in, Parker started making extra cash by running an erotic massage for women business out of his room. The life drawing classes offset our rent by a few $100 a month, so walking in a few nights a week to an impressively cocked naked male model standing on a stage in your living room quickly became normal. There was very little in the way of privacy, which meant that when Parker had a client over, the faint hum and muffled buzz of a vibrator mixed with the unmuffled shrieks and orgasms also became normal. This was not an easy place to bring a date. The only thing I knew about cockroaches was that they were punishingly hard to kill, and they gravitated to dark, moist places. I slept in underpants every single night in that place. But for $333 a month each, what did I really have to complain about? I quickly realized that an internship on the Howard Stern Show opened more doors for me than a second year of college ever could. I got an in-person interview for every single job I applied for, even ones I had zero chance of getting. The Stern Show was at the very top of my resume for years because people would bring me in for interviews just to get the dirt. I was never fully truthful or forthcoming. I'd entertain them, make shit up, tell them what they wanted to hear. I kept everything I actually learned to myself. Within a week of landing in Toronto, I found a student-run salon to chop all my hair off for $12 plus tip, and I did my best to reinvent myself. I wanted to try to be as New York as I could. I spent whatever cash I had at Black Market Vintage on Queen West, buying up old t-shirts, leather jackets, and as many pointy-toed shoes as I could afford. I'd thrown out all my old jeans, all the ones left over from my high school days, and I started exclusively wearing women's jeans. They were tighter in the ass and the thighs and usually had a little flare on the bottom. Other times, I'd leave the house in pajama bottoms, cowboy boots, and an undershirt. I did my best to look cool with what I had. I was a fashion backwards work in progress. In the loft, we kept all our clothes in garbage bags. Nothing ever got hung up or folded away in drawers. Everything I owned went from the dryer straight into a garbage bag with a double knot tied at the top. That gave me the best shot at walking out of the house roach-free after I got dressed every morning. The three of us lived in the loft for just over a year, but I don't remember cooking one single meal in that place. I don't even remember bringing groceries in or even using the fridge. Everything Rich and I ate was takeout or delivery. When we were growing up in Acton, we didn't have delivery. Nobody delivered anything. I never once picked up a phone and had food show up at the door 30 minutes later. This was all new for us. On weekends, we'd split a large pizza, six pieces of fried chicken, and a box of fries from this joint called Double Double. We'd order at 10 in the morning, right when they opened, eat half for breakfast, and save the rest for a late lunch. It was $18 for everything. Then, around 8, we'd order the exact same thing for dinner. We did the math, and three meals for two people at $36 was just a deal too good to pass up. Sometimes we'd get the same delivery guy for round two. He'd see the empty boxes on the counter from the first round of the day, grab them for us, and throw them down the chute on his way out. My brother and I were finally together again. We were happy and bloated. My first job as an actual paying job in radio was chase producing for a news and public affairs show making $18,900 a year. I remember the exact number only because of how happy I was after my first raise, which bumped me up to an even $20,000. A chase producer's job is to book the show. I'd be handed stacks of articles, newspaper clippings, and press releases, all cut up and highlighted with the names of the people they wanted to book for interviews. Then I'd go to work on the phone. I'd track people down all over the world, celebs, authors, academics, criminals, politicians, and book them all. I made it look easy. I was great on the phone. I don't know if it was all those anonymous nights on the chat lines in college, but I could convince anyone to cancel whatever they were doing and come on our show. I was comfortable on the phone, and it was the only time I really felt like I fit in, when I looked like I knew what I was doing. Every other interaction, I faked and fumbled my way through. Anytime I booked a big star, I'd always call my dad and tell him. He thought it was just the greatest. The idea that his boy would be hanging with all these legends and doing a great job really made him proud. And there was nothing like that feeling. I never shattered his bubble, though. I never told him when someone was an asshole. At least, not until I met Mickey Rooney. I'm normally not one to talk shit about the dead, but Mickey Rooney was an asshole. I didn't really know much about him, other than my dad telling me he was a huge fan when I told him I'd book Mickey on the show. Mickey was in town and came in to promote his one-man show or play or something else totally forgettable. My job was to get the guests comfortable in the green room down the hall from the studio and go over the rundown of the show with them. It was a speech I'd given hundreds of times, but I was always nervous doing it. I wasn't great when I had to do face-to-face. Mickey was flopped in the corner of the couch, feet dangling off the side, with his head back and his eyes closed. I got about halfway through telling him how things were going to go down when I started to think he legit just fell asleep while I was talking. I didn't know whether to walk out, poke him, or keep going and just say it all. I was just about to tell him I'd be back in 10 minutes to bring him into the studio when his head shot forward, his eyes wide open, staring a hole through me. He was pissed off. "How old are you?" he asked with a long pause between each word. I'm 20, I answered. "Yeah," he said. "It shows." I'd never seen someone so disgusted to be in the same room with me before. "Out," he said, pointing to the door with one of his little feet before closing his eyes again. Now, what I should have said was, "Get bent, you old little crotch." What I did say was, "Yeah, I know. No problem." I was crushed. I walked back into the office to tell my supervisor what the hell just happened. I was shook, but Paul, who'd hired me for this job, was always great in these situations. "Fuck that guy," he said. "Yeah, I know, but the dude's a legend. He's been in like 300 movies, one of the most famous actors ever." "First off, that guy is barely famous anymore. You want to be famous? I'll tell you what. In 30 seconds, you could easily become just as famous as that asshole. All you have to do is take this pencil, walk back into the green room, and jam it into Mickey Rooney's eye. You'll be one of the most famous people in the world by dinner. You'll be on Larry King tomorrow night. Fame doesn't mean you can just be a dick to whoever you want. And if you are, don't be surprised when every now and then you get a pencil in the eye." Paul said all of this in one single breath and without even looking up from his typewriter, which is how most of our conversations happened. Paul saw something in me all those years ago that most people, especially me, didn't. Potential. This job was the absolute definition of starting from the bottom. I was the hardest working and lowest paid person in the company, and I ate a ton of shit. The rest of the staff on the show could be diabolically cruel, humiliating, and abusive, but I wasn't going to quit, no matter what. This was an opportunity I wasn't going to fuck up. I was preparing for whatever was coming next, no matter how awful I felt at the end of each day. I did not stab Mickey Rooney that afternoon, but I did tell my dad what happened, and for me, knowing that my pop spent the rest of his life telling anyone who would ever listen that Mickey Rooney was a huge asshole was good enough. I've worked two jobs at the same time since I was 20. Even today, I work two full-time jobs, 65 hours a week for two massive and competing companies. I was never the smartest person in the room, but I sure as hell could outwork anyone. Working long hours got me out of my own head, reduced my anxiety, and became the perfect distraction from anything or anyone that could hurt me, especially myself. In 1994, minimum wage was $8.95, so working 17 hours a day was also the only way I could survive and keep working at the radio show. I was desperate and driven, and I found myself a second job for every night and weekend so I wouldn't have to quit the industry. That's how I became, without question, one of the most successful telemarketers Toronto has ever seen. I answered an ad in the back of the Toronto Sun for a job with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra subscription department. It was evenings, the office was right around the corner from the loft, and it was all on the phone. I could do this. I could sell symphony subscriptions and raffle tickets to old people. Now, I don't care how wonderful your organization is or how well you think your business is run. I can guarantee you that your telemarketing department is one of the saddest and sleaziest rooms in your building. This one was no different. I sat beside a woman with thick glasses and thick hair, big home perm curls, who spent most of her time complaining that we didn't have hands-free headsets. So before every shift, she'd reach into her purse, pull out a granny-style knee-high beige stocking, tie it around her head, pulling half of it almost down to her cheek, and jam the ear end of the phone receiver up under it. This was her way of problem-solving, while also protesting. Our boss was a whole other story. He'd spend his time power-tripping, barking orders, and pretending to look normal and inconspicuous as he rubbed his dick on things. I don't know if it was a nervous tic or if he was dealing with something serious down there, but he couldn't stop pinching, squeezing, and pressing it up against anything he could reach with it. All the pants of his cheap gray suits had started to wear thin around there, and by the end of our shift each night, that little spot on the front would be wrinkled and covered in stains from the grease and dirt off his fingers. It was the weirdest thing. If he was standing in front of us for any long period of time, say giving instructions or a pep talk, he'd eventually try to incorporate something like the photocopier or the filing cabinet into what he was saying, just so he could walk over and mash his crotch up against the corner of it. There was a bell at the front of the office that if you made a sale, you'd have to walk up and ring. Anytime that happened, he'd run up to celebrate with you, and after a few high fives, he'd turn around and casually slide his penis across the bottom ledge of the whiteboard we wrote our sales numbers on. I was the only one in the room who noticed, and anytime I did try to point it out to anyone, like the guy who sat across from me and made all his calls in a fake English accent and wore a cape to work every night, no one had any clue what I was talking about. I made almost double my radio salary in that room that year. One morning in the loft, around 6, I got up to go pee. I walked into the bathroom, like I did every morning, and stood in front of the toilet, groggy and a bit hungover. As I pulled the front of my underpants out, I watched a cockroach fall from the inside of my waistband right into the toilet. I'm not sure how long it was there, trapped between the thin strip of elastic and my stomach while I slept, but it was long enough to almost kill it. "Rich!" I yelled loud enough to wake him up on my first try. "Yeah? Can we move?" I shouted. "Okay." Painkiller. I worked an entire half day with a collapsed lung because I was too afraid to let anyone know I needed help. I didn't want to be someone else's problem. I didn't want to let anyone down. I didn't want to get yelled at, and I certainly didn't want to get fired. I'd never taken a sick day or vacation. No matter what I had done in my body the night before, how sick I was, or what kind of shape I was in when I woke up, I always made it into work. My body could take an incredible amount of punishment. I knew this about myself, and nobody ever saw anything I didn't want them to see. This was 1995 or 96, and I was now producing 2 radio shows and working at a video store in the evenings, living roach-free with my brother in a condo we were now renting in the financial district. My friend Alex, who I'd met in college and had moved to New York with, was having a rough time finding a radio job after graduation. So his father bought him a video store to run. His parents were loaded. Alex hired me right away, which meant I could quit telemarketing and instead spend my evenings watching movies and bullshitting with customers. Because of Kevin Smith's Clerks, video store jobs were now the shit. Everybody wanted one. My days always started at 5:30 a.m. I'd leave the condo and walk 2 blocks to pick up the daily newspapers for the show and coffee for everyone who started at the same time I did. Even though I was the lowest paid person on staff, I was the one who did the coffee run every day, and I'd still eat shit if I got an order wrong, even on the mornings when I paid. I'd work a full day until about 5, then hop a subway and a bus uptown to be at the video store for 6. I'd work there until closing, which was usually around 11, then head back downtown and drink hard until last call, which at that point was still 1 a.m. I'd find my way home, do my best not to throw up when I got in, pass out of my clothes, and wake up at 4:46 to start the entire cycle all over again. I'd pound back as much water as my body could handle and take whatever pills I thought would help. Vitamin C, extra strength Tylenol or Advil, and 2 or 3 daytime cold and flu capsules, which always kept me from falling asleep at my desk. I'd spend the first hour in the office piecing together the night before, every day. I think for the most part, we take breathing for granted, like actually breathing. We just do it. It just happens. But if I think about breathing, it's almost like I forget how. If I sit and try to concentrate on my breathing, my heart starts racing. My face gets flush, and I'll have to throw my head back to force air down my throat just to catch my breath. Even today, after I got heavy into transcendental meditation, if I focus on my breathing, I immediately panic. It's irrational, I know, but I can't help it. One unusually warm but rainy mid-September morning, it was still dark when I left the condo to go grab the papers. I was more than used to feeling like absolute death on this walk, but this day was different. Every step came with crushing pain. I felt like I'd been shot or harpooned. My chest was heavy. I was out of breath, and I started to black out. There was a small park near the St. Lawrence Market that I'd sometimes cut through so I could sit on one of the benches and watch the sun come up before walking to the station. It was my favorite spot, but I didn't make it to my bench that day. I couldn't. So I sat on the curb of the road, my shoes in a puddle and my head between my knees, trying to force myself to get it together. I didn't know what to do, so I did what I always did, lit a cigarette and tried to calm the fuck down. I was convinced this was just a side effect of one bad night. One bad night that followed 100 other bad nights. I thought I'd finally done too much. I thought I was dying. I managed to pick myself up, grab the coffee and the papers, and make it to the office. I sat through two meetings, produced an entire show, and made it to lunch without anyone knowing what I was going through. I had an hour for lunch, which I rarely used, but I figured I could make it to the emergency room, see a doctor, get fixed up, and make it back to the station without anyone asking questions. That was the plan anyway. "Hi, how can we help?" the ER nurse asked me. "I can't breathe," I replied. Everything after that is a blur. I was rushed through processing, x-rayed, and wound up on my side, on a bed, in a hallway, while a doctor tried to explain what a chest tube was, how it worked, and why I needed one, immediately. She sliced a tiny hole in between two of my ribs on my right side and pushed what seemed like 2 feet of clear hose into my body, quickly feeding it hand over hand all the way in. I remember the popping sound it made, followed by incredible relief when my lungs drained into a clear plastic container hooked to the bottom of the bed. The doctors told me later that all but 10% of my right lung had collapsed. A nurse put me in a wheelchair, took me over to a bank of phones, and asked if I wanted to call anyone to let them know I needed surgery. The first call I made was to work. The second was to my mom. Piece of advice here. If you're ever in the hospital, not dead, and have to call your mother, the first words out of your mouth should always be, "Mom, everything is okay. I'm going to be fine." Then tell her what happened. Never start the story at the very beginning. Don't make your mom wait. I never did make it back to work that day. In fact, I never made it back to work that fall. The doctors explained I had something called spontaneous pneumothorax and that my lungs were filled with these tiny air blisters that all decided to burst at the exact same time. 2 days later, I went in for surgery to fix my right lung. And 5 hours after that, while still in recovery, my left lung collapsed all the way. My parents were with me at my bedside as much as they could be. My mom was great with everything, but this was really tough on my dad. Even being as out of my mind on morphine as I was, I could still tell he'd just stopped crying every single time he walked into my room. I felt guilty, like I'd somehow let him down. I'd never made my dad cry before. I don't even think I'd ever seen my dad cry. But here we were. When he was in the room with me, he was great. He told me jokes and sneaked in food I wasn't allowed to have. He held my hand, slid his chair in, and rested his head on the side of my bed until he fell asleep watching TV with me. My mom was pretty much living with my brother at this point, sleeping in my bed so she could visit me most days. I didn't have a ton of friends, so besides my family, the only other visitors I had were when Alex showed up with two strippers from the Zanzibar we'd met the week before I went in. He thought this was hilarious and would cheer me up. He wasn't wrong. The doctors took me off morphine and started me on what became a long run of Percocet. In the 90s, nobody ever talked about opioid addiction. These were miracle pills. Nobody really thought about addiction at all. And if you did bring it up, because of course my mother did, what you were told was, as long as you're dealing with pain, there's no chance of addiction, dependency, or side effects. But as we all know now, and they knew then, this was total and complete bullshit. I was drugged for months. My body was in horrid shape, and I wasn't healing nearly as fast as the doctors had hoped. I lost 30 pounds, and I didn't even look like me anymore. For months, I didn't know what day it was. My life was built around the small windows of time in between pills. I didn't know if it was morning or late afternoon, but I sure as hell knew when I was 3 minutes late for my next perk. I also knew that I had fallen totally and completely in love with the night nurse. It was nothing she did. She wasn't flirty or anything. She was just kind, great at her job, and had this way about her that made me think everything was going to be okay. She was beautiful, funny, and always called me by my first name when everyone else used Mr. Weston. She was also the only nurse who was never late with my pills. I remember being so high and telling my mom that I wanted to marry that nurse. I asked my mom, insisted she go to the gift shop to get me flowers that I could give to the nurse. She did, and I gave them to her. I'm not sure what my nurse did with them, but she never made me feel like a loser for shooting my shot. About a week before I was discharged, that same nurse came into my room. It was late, so she woke me up. She explained there was a virus ripping through the hospital, and they needed to make sure I didn't have it. Okay, I said, do whatever you have to do. At this point, I'd had so many needles, tubes, and hands stuffed in me, nothing mattered anymore. Can you roll over for me? She asked while pulling my blankets down on my ankles. Yeah, just roll over real quick for me. I rolled over onto my side, and she opened up the back of my hospital gown. I'd never felt more exposed or unattractive, ever. I was in love with this woman, and up to this point, I'd always tried to look my best with what I had going on, which wasn't much. And here she was, about to swab the inside of my ass, an ass that had been lying in a bed for 2 months, an ass that hadn't seen sun in even longer, the ass of her future husband. The whole process took about 3 seconds, then she covered me up, rolled me back over, pulled my blankets up, and said, all right, all set. I'll have someone come up tomorrow and take a look at that hemorrhoid for you. It's a big one. Fucking kill me. The only word to describe what it's like having a chest tube removed, two chest tubes actually, is violent. It's a brutal process that can't be done gently. A nurse stands beside your bed with all their weight on their back foot, like they're about to throw a punch. Then they put one hand on your ribs to hold you still, and with the other hand, they rip. They yank that thing out of you like they're starting a chainsaw. You can feel every inch of it leaving your body. It's almost demonic, like an exorcism. It was snowing when I finally got home from the hospital. That's how long I'd been there. I was home in my own bed, but at that point, I was still dealing with a slight infection, which quickly became a severe infection. My mom sat with me all night with a cold cloth on my forehead as I begged her not to take me back to the hospital. To get me through the worst of it, they sent me home with antibiotics and enough Percocet to start a business. I'd never seen a pill bottle that big before, and I still haven't. It was about an inch shorter than a beer can, but just as wide. Hundreds of them. But now there was no nurse to make sure I took them on time or with any sort of regularity. There were no rules. I walked with a cane for a few weeks and started back at work mid-November. I'd also figured out how to get the most out of the pills I had left, which was a shit ton. I knew the times of day I was at my best, and when I felt my worst, I managed the actual pain naturally, fought through it, and saved the pills for when I wasn't in agony, almost like a reward for going through so much shit. I always felt as good as I was going to get in the morning, right after a shower, so that's when I'd take two. By 3 p.m, I'd be in actual hell, sweating and dizzy, and I'd ride it out with nothing. I had built a routine, a system, that kept me high for most of the day. Nothing mattered. I was in an impenetrable fog. Work stress became non-existent. But I wasn't addicted. That was impossible. The pills ran out after about a month and a half, but I wasn't pissed. They were a way to get me through the day. Nothing more than that, really. I looked at them like a gift or a fun ride that was now over. I really didn't think too much about it. But when the pills ran out, I got sick. Really fucking sick. I had dealt with so much that year, and it had been months since I actually felt normal. So being sick was something that I was used to. But this was a different kind of sick. and I was a different kind of person now. I took another 2 weeks off work and called my doctor to get more antibiotics because I was sure the infection was back. None of that was true. I was kicking an opioid addiction I didn't know I had, alone in my room with Gravol and fucking Gatorade. It was years before I understood what actually happened. Early that spring, I had an appointment with a specialist who wanted to test me for Marfan syndrome. A doctor had recommended this months before because I was a tall, young male and skeletal. Apparently, I was the poster child for Marfans. I didn't know much about Marfans, which is fine, because I didn't have Marfans. But after three appointments with three different doctors, I was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome. The diagnosis explained everything, especially all those years my brother called me twitchy. But the thing I never thought was a thing was now a thing, and I hated it. I took the diagnosis and walked out of that room and never talked about it again. I never even went back for my follow-up appointment, and I certainly wasn't interested in being medicated. When I was sick, alone, and high in the hospital bed, thinking I was going to die, I spent a lot of time in my own head. In the brief moments of clarity in between pills, I made the decision to chase opportunity. Money became secondary. From that point on, I promised myself I would become an opportunity hunter, and I was going to make damn sure I was ready when it came. I needed to educate myself. I needed to learn from the best no matter what. No matter how I was treated, no matter how much shit I ate, no matter how much it killed me inside, learn from the smartest people. That was my rule. I ate with that fork. The first time you look in the mirror and don't recognize the person staring back at you is going to be the worst day of your life. That's the good news. The bad news is that likely won't be the last time it happens. I got very used to days like that, too used to them. I was 22 and I'd placed my entire self-worth in the hands of someone else. My identity and future were entirely dictated by my new boss. And I let it happen. I walked away from the radio show and took a gig booking and producing a network TV talk show. Think Larry King, but with zero budget and shitty lighting. This was a senior position on a small team, the kind of job that normally would and should go to someone with far more experience than I had. This was a fantastic opportunity. I'd never been more unhappy. When you're young and insecure, unsure, and racked with self-doubt, you tend to lean into loyalty. You offer it up to anyone who'll take it, even if they don't deserve it, especially if they don't deserve it. It's a way to make your mark and get ahead when you have little else to offer. And this new relationship with my executive producer was the most codependent, manipulative, and unhealthy relationship I've ever had. But I was loyal as fuck. I was responsible for managing her career and her mental state. Her personal drama became my personal drama. I built her show and her confidence. I protected her. She hired me for a job I wasn't even close to being qualified for, and I felt like I owed her, so I gave her everything. People couldn't stand her, which meant they couldn't stand me either. Half our coworkers looked at me like I was her pet. The other half thought we were sleeping together, and I didn't blame them one bit for thinking any of it. That all said, she was incredibly smart, fucking brilliant actually, an unbelievable producer, and one of the best writers I've ever met. I followed her around and hung off her every word. I studied her. She saw us as something different, though. This was personal to her. She was convinced and would tell anyone who'd listen that we were so much alike. We were the same person. Truth is, she had no idea who I was because she never bothered to look. If we went out for drinks after work, which was often mandatory, she'd always order for the two of us and use me as an excuse to get an entire bottle of wine instead of just a single glass for herself. I hated wine, but she never asked. She'd order the foie gras appetizer and push half of it onto my plate. Then she'd eat all the little pieces of bread that came with it, so I had to down all mine by the spoonful, gagging with every bite. Everything she ate with her hands, scooping up whatever was left on the plate with the underside of her fingernail. Everything she loved, I hated, and she'd always order enough for both of us. Then we'd split the bill, and I'd pay the tip. I could never say anything, of course, because I knew just what would happen if I did. the same thing that always happened. She'd ignore me for a few days, make me redo all my work, cancel entire shows I'd work my ass off to book, and call me drunk and crying at 3 a.m. to scream, "Why are you trying to ruin my life?" before I even had a chance to say hello. Over these couple of years, I quietly but relentlessly tried to reinvent myself to make up for lost time and wasted years in high school and college. I don't think I'd ever read an entire book. I still haven't. Don't get me wrong. I've almost or pretty much read dozens of books. But have I ever read an entire book cover to cover without skipping a few words or paragraphs, skimmed lines I thought were boring, spaced out for a minute and forgot where I was, or put it down and failed to pick it up exactly where I left off? No, not ever. So I read through as much as I could of every single book that came through the office. I had stacks of them all over my desk at work and boxes full of books in my closet at home. I'd take the entire week to get through the Sunday New York Times, Time, Newsweek, The Economist, and Vanity Fair, all of them, cover to cover. I'd go to academic lectures at the library and sit through boring political debates when they hosted those too. On days when we didn't have a show, I'd watch CNN, Jerry Springer Without Shame, and PBS, then head to the city courthouse and sit through a random trial just so I could hear how smart people argued and made a point. I had Christopher Hitchens' direct office number and would call him and do these monster, extra-long pre-interviews when I booked him as a guest. This was my education. I quizzed and talked the ear off any intelligent guest we ever had on the show, then followed up on my own on everything they said. I never knew if I was actually good at my job or if I was just excellent at doing exactly what my boss told me to do. Most days, I felt like a total fraud, and I was convinced it was only a matter of time before everyone figured it all out. Even on days when I did do my best work, I still felt like I was faking my way through it, like it was all one big hustle. I was convinced that without this job, without her, I was nothing. She had nicknames for people we worked with, like Fat Ass Francis, and if you didn't use them, she wouldn't hear you until you did. "Hey," I'd say, "Fran said we couldn't run late in the studio today." "Who?" she'd ask without even looking up. "Francis," I'd say. "Who?" she'd ask again, still not looking up, but raising both eyebrows and cocking her head to one side. "Fat Ass Francis," I'd finally answer. "What does she want now?" Francis was not fat, and I never really noticed her ass, but from what I remember, it wasn't anything other than perfectly normal sized. But this is what my boss did. She hammered stuff like that into your head, made it normal, hoping it would one day escape the lab, and I'd be the one to slip up and say something out loud close enough for Francis to hear it. That way, she could hurt her, or whoever else, without taking any of the blame. Every day was a demoralizing indoctrination. Fully comply, or you were dead to her. I sat with her for hours at the hairdresser 3 days a week just to keep her company, because her stylist had long gotten sick of her shit and no longer talked to her. She'd go on about how everyone was out to get her, how everyone was out to get us, how the world was Walmart, and she was sick of having to dumb things down for the masses. Each week, she told me who I needed to hate and how we were in this together because everybody was coming for our heads. It was us against the world. She was paranoid and irrational. Two little elves is what she used to call us. And whether I thought I deserved it or not, I was now 24 years old, making $75,000 a year, a salary she negotiated for me and never let me forget it. Most mornings, I arrived at work a little after 6. At this point, we worked at two small connected offices. Mine had a desk and a large, round, heavy wood coffee table in the middle of it, stacked 2 feet high with her old newspapers, books, lipstick stained napkins, and last week's takeout containers. The building staff had long since stopped cleaning the room because every time they did, my boss would swear something went missing and accuse them of stealing. When I'd get in, I'd drop a stack of newspapers on my desk, then walk directly into her office and crank up the heat. All the way. Every day, I got that room humming. It got to 90 degrees in under an hour, uncomfortably and unbearably hot. My boss was a lot of things, but late was the one you could always bet on. I always heard her coming. She burst through that last door in the hallway like a high-heeled tank, a devil in pleather. When I heard her, I'd jump up, sprint in, turn her thermostat back down to something normal, and race back out to my desk. Every single morning, she stormed in, threw her purse on the chair from across the room, dropped whatever else was in her hands on my desk, grabbed a piece of whatever I was eating with her fingers, and marched directly into her blazing hot office. For the first 30 minutes of her day, every day, she was in hell, agitated, angry, and sweaty, while she sat on the phone with building maintenance, shrieking, "The thermostat! The thermostat!" at some poor soul who didn't deserve any of it. I'd casually walk in to fiddle around with the little dial, using bullshit precision. Sometimes, I'd even put my ear to it, like I was cracking a safe. "There," I'd say, "I think I heard it kick in. There was definitely a click." Of course, I did absolutely nothing, and the room would cool down 15 minutes later all on its own. But I was the hero. I had the magic touch. These were the best 30 minutes of my day. Every day. I never really talked about work when I got home or if I was ever out for drinks with friends. And if I ever did mention anything, I'd only give them a fraction of what my days were actually like. Even then, they'd be horrified. But I didn't want anyone's opinion, advice, or judgment. So, for the most part, I just shut up about it. I added everything to the stack, that place inside us where we keep all these things, all the shit we don't talk about. Rich and I moved up the street and rented a proper two-bedroom condo, which meant I didn't have to sleep on a futon in the solarium anymore. And we got our own bathrooms. That's where I spent most of my days after work. I'd grab an ashtray and a beer from the fridge and sit naked, sideways, on the toilet so I couldn't see myself in the mirror and go up my thighs and everything else with a lighter and the end of a hot pin. I'd be in there long enough to finish off a king can and smoke 3 cigarettes back to back. Then I'd stand up in front of the mirror, staring into the bottom of the sink while trying to push my fists through the top of the counter. I'd let up when I couldn't feel my hands anymore, take a few deep breaths, get dressed, and rejoin the world like none of it ever happened. My boss had this incredible talent for framing every critique and compliment or opinion in the exact same way. The first words out of her mouth were always, "You know what your problem is?" What followed could be anything from, "You're just too good looking," to, "You just don't fucking listen." No matter what it was, though, I'd always get one of her long, unkempt acrylic nails waving 2 inches from my face as she went on and on. She was convinced she knew more about everybody than they knew about themselves. She was that type. One night, we went out for oysters. Her idea, not mine. I knew this night was coming because she'd informed me 2 days before. I'd never had oysters before, but she assumed I loved them because she loved them. This was a new spot that she was dying to try, and if I didn't go, she'd have to eat alone in public, which, of course, would be all my fault and would absolutely ruin my next 2 weeks. I was terrified I was going to gag and make a whole scene. The night before we went out, I went to a restaurant around the corner from our condo, sat at the bar, and ordered 3 shots of vodka and 1 lonely oyster. I needed to know what I was getting myself into, and I quickly realized that I'd need to be way more drunk than I was to ever do that again. So there we were, drunk and on our 10th round of, "You know what your problem is?" as she tried to analyze and fix my life, like somehow telling me, "You just need all new friends," was in any way constructive. I was more than used to this. Her never-ending, self-pity-filled rants could go on for hours. I sat quietly in the oyster bar, nodding and agreeing while throwing out things like, "Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, thank you," whenever I could get a word in. I didn't have the tools or the self-esteem to argue, fight back, or stand up for myself, so I took it. When she leaned forward, slurring while schooling me on how much harder I needed to work for, I took it and said nothing. When she casually reached across the table, grabbed my little oyster fork, and used it to clean under her fingernails before sliding it back beside my plate like nothing happened, I took it and said nothing. When the oysters finally arrived, I ate with that fork, and I said nothing. I never really had a good handle on what it meant to be successful, and I certainly hadn't ever felt successful. I didn't know what I wanted to become, but I sure as fuck knew how I wanted to feel. The bar was now set. At that moment, gagging on the food and every word I should have said but didn't, I knew I never wanted to feel like this ever again. Powerless. I never wanted to feel like I had to eat with a fork that someone just dug bits of shit out from under their nail with because saying something would somehow embarrass them. I kept my head down, planned my escape, and prepped for the next opportunity. I knew that capitalizing on opportunity outside of my comfort zone was the only way I was going to get out. I knew I had to separate myself from my boss and learn new shit, new skills. New skills would lead to more opportunity, then eventual freedom. I didn't know how to get there, but I knew I had to try. I had no choice. To me, freedom is simple. It's two things. The ability to confidently tell someone no and have it be respected. And the willingness to walk away from anything without hesitation or fear. No regrets. The people I'd work for needed to know this. They'd need to know where they stood in my world, not the other way around. I worked another 4 years with my boss on that show. La La Lexi. In late 1999, I spent $25,000 of my company's money to fly an entire television crew to California just to meet a girl who left me stranded alone at 2 a.m. at a dildo store on Sunset Boulevard. This was the calm before the millennium and my first trip to Los Angeles. I had no intention of ever going home. Of course, none of that worked out, but I did meet O.J. Simpson at the hotel bar, woke up to an earthquake, and spent 2 days at the Playboy Mansion. Also, dildo store. That's how my year ended. Now let me tell you how I got there. In the few years leading up to this, the TV show had grown, so we now had more staff, which took some of the heat off me, but I was still somewhat ostracized and definitely not trusted by my coworkers. I did my best to bond and be cool with everyone else, but I always got the sense that people were holding back, as if anything they said to me was going to get back to our boss. People still thought we were sleeping together. The show was now produced out of a small corner of a much larger area in the newsroom, with 6 desks, a TV, and 1 computer with the internet. The desk in the far back was empty and semi-private. It was surrounded on 3 sides with cubicle wall, and nobody ever went back there. This was the cry corner. At least a few times a month, one of the people on the show, a producer, intern, or researcher, would wind up back there to just let it out. My boss had carefully crafted and expertly curated the most toxic work environment any of these people had ever experienced. It was a work of art. It was and still is legendary. And the few years leading up to 1999 were a revolving door. New people would be hired from outside. Others transferred to our show from other departments at the station. None of them lasted. One woman I worked with, a wicked talented producer with more than a decade of experience, pulled me aside on her last day. "Get away from her," she told me. "Far away from her." I did not listen. Every now and then, someone on staff would ask me how I managed to do it. How I hadn't killed her or myself after all the years I'd been there. What I wanted to say was, "Well, that's because I'm dead inside." But what I always replied, without fail, was, "You get used to it." This never went over well, because it was never enough. It was a bullshit answer, and they all knew it. Truth was, I had no identity. So much of my self-worth was tied up in what I did for the show, what I did for my boss. That job was my life, and I measured my days based on how much abuse and manipulation I could handle while still moving forward. How I felt didn't matter, and I considered any day that I could actually stomach food a huge win. I convinced myself that happiness at work was a luxury for the weak. But I never wanted anyone to feel the way I did. I'd always try to help the other staff through the rough parts, and when our boss left the building, which was always within 60 seconds of the show wrapping, I'd let everyone know she was gone and watch a collective sigh wash over our small crew. Every day after work, I took 2 buses, a subway, then a streetcar back downtown. The whole trip took just over 90 minutes. I never read or listened to music or made small talk with other commuters. I always sat alone, but never liked being alone. I was always more comfortable on a bus rammed with people than one that was empty. Most nights, I stopped for a beer at a bar, then headed home to mess around on the internet before leaving for a club. Everything was new then. There was no Instagram, Amazon, or iTunes, and everything online took forever. If you did a Yahoo search for boobs but forgot an O, you'd wait a full 5 minutes for a page of famous Bobs to show up before you could fix your mistake. I quickly became a Bob expert. I remember watching CNN when they were doing a story about virtual chat rooms, and I was hooked. According to them, these were either the future of human connection or a predator's playground. Turns out, they were both. The best was CUCME, developed in the early 90s by Cornell University. By today's standards, it was laughable and archaic. Absolute shit. Black and white, pixelated, and choppy as hell. Imagine a Zoom call with 20 strangers who looked like 8-bit Mario characters with a 45-second refresh rate, if you were lucky. I used these off and on from about 1997, talking to strangers and flirting. Doing anything sexual was always an embarrassing disaster, so for the most part, we kept our clothes on. I never used a fake name like I had on the telephone chat lines in college, but otherwise, the experience was very much the same. I was always more comfortable talking to people I knew nothing about, who knew nothing about me. Some of my closest relationships were entirely based on typing 4 or 5 words at a time and holding up hand-drawn pictures to a webcam sketched out on a Post-it. I chatted off and on with a woman named Alexis. Lala Lexi 2001 was her handle. She was in her mid-30s, cool as hell, and we'd meet up on CUCME around the time I got home from work, which was mid-afternoon for her in L.A. She was a SoCal short-haired blonde with dark roots who worked in big tech. I really didn't know what big tech was then, but she seemed to be doing okay for herself. When we were online, she'd grab her camera to walk it around her giant warehouse space in Studio City and show me around. She and her crew rode dirt bikes inside. They had a wall of TVs just for video games, and every now and then, she flashed stacks of cash to the camera. She was loaded. She said she was loaded, anyway. She called me and everyone else bitch before it was cool and had the most incredible tan lines I'd ever seen over black and white dial-up video. I'd never met anyone like her. She was a little bit of Emily Valentine from 90210 mixed with Watts from Some Kind of Wonderful and a whole lot of Helen Slater from The Legend of Billie Jean. Going into 1999, if you worked in TV, your life was consumed with Y2K and the millennium. There was mass media, mass hysteria, and everyone was losing their shit. Shows spent tons of cash to build over-the-top year-end shows. These meetings had been going on for months. In late fall, after weeks in a boardroom and hundreds of ideas tossed around, someone suggested we do something around Hugh Hefner and Playboy's millennium issue. Hef was hot at the time. He was freshly divorced, and he was back. GQ or Esquire had just done a huge feature on him and how the mansion, after years of being a family home, was once again open for sad and pervy business. I immediately shot up my hand and yelled over everyone, "I have a contact at the Playboy Mansion." I had no contact at the Playboy Mansion. I followed that up with, "I can get us an interview with Hef and get a camera into their millennium party. No problem." Again, I knew nobody at the Playboy Mansion. "Yes," my boss yelled, "Sex 2000, Sin is in." She was already coming up with titles for the special. I got to it. This was all I knew how to do. I worked the phones, lied, and promised the moon to anyone at Playboy who'd take my call. By the end of the next week, I delivered on everything I'd promised in that meeting. This was by far the biggest hustle I'd ever pulled off, although that year I'd put some impressive shows together and booked more impossible guests than I could count. I really hated work, but I was goddamn good at it, and I built an incredible reputation as the guy who could book anyone. But the Playboy thing I was particularly proud of. It was a way to covertly get back at my boss for all the shit I'd put up with and at the company that sat back and said nothing. We hired a kick-ass crew, got the budget approved, and off we went. A day with Hef and full camera access to the Millennium Party at the Playboy Mansion. The Playboy Mansion was in Los Angeles. Lala Lexi was in Los Angeles. "Roz, get your ass in here, bitch!" These were the first words Lala Lexi said to me in person. She was parked, taking up two spots out front of my hotel in an old Jeep, standing up on the driver's seat, hanging out the top, jumping and waving her arms around while screaming at me. I didn't have a cell phone that worked in America, so this whole date was set up over email before I left Toronto. The crew and I had just landed a few hours earlier, and I was dealing with jet lag for the first time in my life. I was exhausted and knew I had to be up early the next morning to head to the Playboy Mansion, so I promised myself I wasn't going to go too hard. Lexi was fucking rad, and she was making a total scene. I'd never actually heard her voice clearly and was blown away by just how LA she sounded. She didn't seem real. I didn't know her, and she sure as hell didn't know me, but when I jumped into that Jeep and kissed her for the first time, I was done. That was it. It was goddamn electric. She reached behind the passenger seat, grabbed a king can of Bud, jammed it between my legs, and told me to keep it down as she peeled out of the parking lot. "Do you want the bullshit PG tourist version of LA or the trashy version of LA? My version. Okay, good." She said all this even before I had a chance to open my mouth. For the next 4 or 5 hours, we did it all with the roof down. I was still a mystery to her. She knew nothing about me and didn't seem to care. I'd never felt so free. This was a total reinvention for me, a bloody awakening. After we drove through the hills, stopping every now and then to make out a little and crush another beer, she took me down to Sunset Boulevard. We passed the Whiskey, the Roxy, and the Rainbow Room. This was the exact strip of road that bred every band I ever loved growing up. It felt like home, like I'd gone to the mothership. I was always drawn to Southern California. When my dad was 18, lost and broken and in desperate need of a fresh start and reinvention, he wound up in LA. He found his escape in the United States Marine Corps. I found mine in Lala Lexi. A girl who within the first hour of meeting had me barefoot, standing with her on the front hood of her purple Jeep, with her face pressed against my back and her hands reached around my waist, jammed into my front pockets as we slow danced under the California stars. The whole thing was weird, wonderful, and totally embarrassing. But so was Los Angeles. Lala Lexi kissed with her eyes open, tasted like vanilla and American cigarettes, and flicked the front of my pants and yelled, "Whoopsie," when she accused me of having a boner. I'd never seen a palm tree before, and here I was, fallen in love like a guy in a poorly reviewed Hollywood rom-com with a leading man nobody would ever pay money to see. All of this with a total stranger I'd met on the internet. California was everything my dad said it was. His stories of LA in the late 60s were fascinating, and like all his other stories, they evolved over the years. My story was evolving by the minute. As we drove down Sunset for the third time, I put my head against the back of the seat, closed my eyes, and rehearsed how I was going to tell my parents I'd met the love of my life on my first night in LA. I was never coming home because there was no coming back from this. I was brand new. I was writing my own love story, second by second, that would blow even my parents away. "Here we go, hang on," Lexi half laughed, half yelled, as she whipped the Jeep into a parking space right out front of a sex shop on Sunset. This place was nothing really special at all, average, actually, but Lexi walked in there like it was her second home. She seemed to know where everything was and cruised the aisles, loading up a basket like she was picking apples. Fuzzy things, hard things, leather things, things that took double D batteries, all the things. I slapped my company Amex card on the counter, paid for everything, and she helped the guy who worked there load it all up into a black plastic bag. She was in a hurry, and I was nervous as hell. As we were about to walk out, she grabbed a shirt off the last rack, whipped around, held it up to my chest, and said, "You need this. I love this for you. Try it on." As she let the hanger go, I caught it before it hit the floor, then made my way to the change room. The shirt was hideous. It was a black mesh half shirt with the number 69 spray painted on the front in bright red bubble font. I was wearing super casual pants because I'd come from dinner with the crew before we hooked up, so now I had to pull off pleats with a belly shirt. Not a strong look. I walked out to do a quick spin in the mirror, dying of embarrassment, but still laughing. I could see pretty much the entire store in the reflection behind me, and Lexi was gone. I was alone, in mesh. I awkwardly walked over to the guy behind the counter, covering my exposed stomach with both hands. "Did you see?" That's all I managed to get out before he looked up at me and shrugged. He didn't say anything. He just shrugged. Then he called me a cab. On any regular day, the Playboy Mansion was just a sad old house full of sad old men. Everyone I met on staff was Hef's age and just shuffled around trying to look busy. My first day there was what they called an off day, which meant no parties, no famous movie night, no naked shenanigans, no bunnies, and no booze. But I did get to play with a monkey. As we wrapped the first half of our interview, which took about 90 minutes, we were invited to have lunch with Hef out back on the patio beside the infamous grotto. It was taco day. As we were slowly escorted out at a senior's pace, I took note of every single piece of furniture we passed. Everything was oversized, thick, and heavy. Old wood, red velvet, and built for one thing and one thing only. Even the end tables looked strong enough to hold two people. Comfortably. We toured the kitchen, which was huge and industrial, like something you'd see in the back of a restaurant. One of the chefs yelled, "Who's ready for tacos?" as he and a few other people followed us out with trays and trays of food. I'd never had a real California taco before, let alone one handmade by a real Mexican chef, so I was pumped. My dad loved tacos and would always lecture us on what an authentic SoCal taco was supposed to taste like. It took one bite, without even swallowing, for me to realize.